You're listening to WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, broadcasting at 99.3 FM and streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Grant Faulkner, who is a very busy man this week. He is executive director of National Novel Writing Month, or NaNoWriMo, which begins on Wednesday because Wednesday is November 1st. If you are not aware, NaNoWriMo is, and this is from their website, a fun seat-of-your-pants approach to creative writing. On November 1st, participants begin working towards the goal of writing a 50,000-word novel by 11:59 p.m. on November 30th. Valuing enthusiasm, determination, and a deadline, NaNoWriMo is for anyone who has ever thought about writing a novel. So you'll get to hear a lot more about it in our next interview. Before I begin that, I will give you a little information about Grant. This is his bio in his own words. As a boy, I spent my allowance on all sorts of pens and paper, so there was never much question I would become a writer. I received my BA from Grinnell College in English and my MA in creative writing from San Francisco State University. It seems like I should have other degrees, such as an MFA in novels about people doing nothing but walking around, a PhD in collages and doodles and stick drawings of fruitless pursuits, or a knighthood in insomniac studies, but I don't. My essays on creativity have been published in the New York Times, Poets and Writers, Writer's Digest, and The Writer. My short stories have appeared in dozens of literary magazines, including Tin House, The Southwest Review, and Puerto del Sol. My stories have also been included in Best Small Fictions 2016 and in the upcoming Norton anthology, New Microfiction. My collection of 100-word stories, Fishers, came out in 2015 with Press 53, and Pep Talks for Writers, 52 Insights and Actions to Boost Your Creative Mojo, was published by Chronicle Books in 2017. I'm also the executive director of National Novel Writing Month, co-founder of the Lit Journal 100-word Story, and co-founder of the Flash Fiction Collective. Oh, and I've presented at such shindigs as the Frankfurt Book Fair, the Chicago Humanities Festival, the Associated Writing Programs Conference, Book Expo America, the Oakland Book Festival, the Bay Area Book Festival, the San Francisco Writers Conference, the Commonwealth Club, the Digital Publishing Innovation Summit, Writer's Digest West, and Lit Quake. So, it's a mouthful. That's Grant's bio. And I have to tell you, when I spoke with Grant last week, it was raining very hard in Burlington, and you can hear that in the interview because I have a skylight in the area where I was doing the interview, and I apologize for that. Actually, I find it kind of pleasant to listen to, but to the extent that you find it distracting, I am sorry. and I apologize to Grant, but it's not that bad. And when I spoke with Grant last week, I asked if we could begin by going over the history of NaNoWriMo. What is it all about, and who is it for? I hope you enjoy our conversation.
National Novel Writing Month, in its simplest form, is a challenge to write 50,000 words in 30 days during the month of November. But it's really much more than that. It's so much about the galvanizing community that's involved in novel writing. Last year, we had 312,000 people sign up on our main site, and then we had another 80,000 kids and teens sign up for our Young Writers Program.
Wow.
And we have a vibrant online community, but then we have a really wonderful, encouraging in-person community as well. We have 1,000 volunteers who we call municipal liaisons, and they organize in-person events in local communities around the world. And we also work with 1,000 libraries who organize live writing events.
Yeah, it's a very cool project. I have done, I think just once before, I did a NaNoWriMo show where I interviewed people that were participating. And so I don't know if you know the novelist Tammy Greenwood. She does it every year, and that's how she gets her first draft written, and she's quite a successful author. And then there's also a local family here in Burlington, Vermont, that the whole family does it. Like the mother, the dad, and the kids all take the month of November and put out 4 novels by the end of the month.
That is so cool. There is a family also in my hometown of Oskaloosa, Iowa, who has done NaNoWriMo together, and I'm so heartened by those stories.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, parents will ask me, how can I possibly write a novel? you know, as a working parent, it's certainly very challenging. But the best way is actually to get your kids to write with you.
Yeah. Yeah, especially, yeah. And I don't know if this family still does it every year, but they did it several years in a row, I know. So that was pretty cool.
That's great. It's a wonderful shared experience as a family, you know.
Yeah.
I love witnessing those families where they are talking about their stories with each other, and they make creativity a family experience.
Now, you are the executive director of NaNoWriMo. So is that a full-time, year-round job? Is that what you do all the time?
It is.
Yeah,
A lot of people ask me, what do you do the other 11 months a year, or what do you do for a day job? You know, it takes a lot. We have a staff of 8, actually.
Yeah.
We are a nonprofit in Berkeley. We have a $1.3 million budget.
Wow.
And we have year-round programming, too. NaNoWriMo happens in November, but it takes a lot of work to take care of 400,000 people and 5,000 schools.
Yeah, no.
1,000 libraries. And then we have I Wrote a Novel, Now What?, which focuses on revision and publishing in January and February.
Right.
And then we host what we call Camp NaNoWriMo in April and July. And it's a more casual version of NaNoWriMo. About 70,000 people in total sign up for that.
Yeah.
And then we do other initiatives throughout the year as well.
I was just going to say that when I asked that question, it's because I had assumed it was a full-time, year-round job. And then when I was reading your book, there was some mention of going to work, but you didn't mention NaNoWriMo in that sentence, and I thought, surely he doesn't have another job, does he?
Yeah, I know. When I'm asked if I'm a volunteer, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm writing books, and I have another day job on top of this. It'd be totally nuts.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about Pep Talks for Writers. How did you decide to write this book?
Yeah, it definitely was spawned by NaNoWriMo. I talk to so many writers, and so many people find themselves as writers and creators during NaNoWriMo each November, and they leave November with the best intentions to keep writing and to do it year-round. But I think writing year-round is a really challenging thing. I compare it to people whose New Year's resolutions, for instance, are to exercise more, and so they buy a gym membership in January, and they show up, and they exercise a lot in January, maybe carry that over into February, but by March, I think there's a statistic that says something like 80% of those people are no longer going to the gym.
Mm.
But they intend to, and going to the gym is good for them, just as I feel like writing year-round is good for people. And so this book is really dedicated. I mean, there are 52 essays. That 52 wasn't a coincidence.
Yeah.
It's meant to prod people to think of their creativity as a year-round exercise, to make it a priority, and also to develop a creative mindset. You know, and that creative mindset, I mean, I think it's important when you sit down to write, but it's also important just in your life and thinking about your life as one big activity or experience to nourish your creativity on the page.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, have you ever thought of doing a NaNoWriMo, which is like maybe revision month in March?
Yeah. Well, that's what I Wrote a Novel, Now What? Program is in January and February.
Okay.
So we help encourage people, and we provide resources and a conversation to help them revise and to think about publishing. And then we've developed a number of different tools on our website to help people continue writing and revise their novels. And we're currently redesigning our website, and we're even exploring the idea of having a revision boot camp.
Great.
So, yeah. Writing a novel is it's a big creative journey, and we specialize in helping people write the rough draft. That's what we do better than anyone else on the planet. But
right.
We also want to support people in those next stages.
Yeah, I did sign up for NaNoWriMo one year, and then it turned out not to work for me timing-wise. But I really enjoyed seeing what the community looked like, and the way that there's like daily posts that are very inspiring, and there's just a lot of support there. It was really fun to see that.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Why didn't it work for you? Is it timing?
Well, actually, I think we have something in common. Where you mentioned in the book that you're a slow writer, and I'm an incredibly slow writer. I've written 5 novels. It's not that I never get around to finishing one, but I don't know that I can contain what I do in a month. Plus, at the time, I had little kids and I had other work, and other people do it. I just didn't succeed. So.
Yeah. I mean, I totally get where you're coming from. When I hear stories like that, I always advise people to, I mean, it's great that you gave it a shot, and maybe now if your kids have grown up more or if your life is more accommodating, I would give it a shot just to shake up your creative process. And that's actually the reason I initially did NaNoWriMo.
Yeah.
I kind of questioned whether I had determined my creative process or if it just kind of found me. So I wanted to be less passive about my creative process. And so I did NaNoWriMo. And, you know, that ability to write with abandon, as we say, to write fast and to only focus on progress. And you can even take the writing fast out of it. Just write to only focus on progress.
Yeah.
It can be an interesting creative process, and I don't do it all the time, but it's in my writer's toolkit. So if I, you know, just want to, and I even use it in revision, because sometimes revision, you have to write new scenes, or you have to almost have a brainstorming process. So I'll kind of jump in and give myself a little word sprint challenge and write with abandon for just like 5 minutes, just to get things going.
And I will say you call it the sprint, and I know that you mentioned Pomodoro, the Pomodoro technique in that section of this book. That's been really helpful to me, that sort of put on a timer and just like pour it out and then take a break and do it again and take a break and do it again. So why do you think this is so successful? How do you think that works? The creative process of writing sprints.
Yeah, you know, it's really fascinating. I was just at an event last night, and there were probably 40 people there, and I did a word sprint with them, and it was a simple prompt, 5-minute challenge, write as much as you can.
Yeah.
And every single person in that room, one person only wrote 60 words, but another person wrote 400 words, and they were all handwriting, so it wasn't even on a laptop.
Wow.
And so what it did to me is it proved that writer's block doesn't exist. I've done word sprints with thousands of people now, and everyone has written. So I think it gives, one, it just opens up the gate and gives you permission to write.
Yes.
Another thing that's great about it is, you know, it's what's amazing to me is that we don't know what, you know, you don't plan for a word sprint. You just go. And yet our mind has this ability to create a story instantaneously. And it's an improvisational writing exercise. And so I think oftentimes when we're writing, we don't trust that everything's there, you know. We just need to open up the gates and allow it to come out.
Right.
And so I think that, you know, the word sprints are really good because you are definitely banishing your inner editor. They help you do that. And they also, by that sort of fast writing and improvisational writing technique, I think they can help you identify the story. You go deeper, you take creative risks by doing that.
Okay. All right. Great. And actually, I jumped ahead in my questions because it came up, but I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the specific tips in the book. And your first one is titled, You Don't Need Permission to Be a Creator. And I think that really speaks to the insecurity that seems to be sort of epidemic in writers. And I wondered if you have any ideas about why we are so insecure about this.
You know, I've thought about this a lot, and I don't know that I have any great ideas, but I do think that there's something... It's just so challenging to have the words on the page match the ideas in your mind, you know, and I don't know if it's just as challenging for painters or for musicians, but there's just such a gap between being able to perfectly express that idea on the page, and it takes so much, you know. I mean, like the rough draft, in some ways it's best not to do that, because then you will just get have this kind of overwrought experience with trying to write that perfect first sentence or that perfect first chapter.
Right.
And to arrive at that, it really takes like numerous rounds of revisions. And I guess that's what, you know, like one obstacle is getting hung up on that idea of perfection and trying to make your prose match your favorite author's prose. I think that's it too. It's a comparison. And what we don't realize when we're reading our favorite author's prose, or it's kind of invisible to us, is all the, you know, that novel we love has gone through, you know, perhaps 5 or 10 revisions and had professional editors look at it.
Right.
You know? And so comparing our rough draft to that is a really unfair comparison. And I wish we could get a little glimpse into our favorite author's rough drafts, because I bet they look a lot like our rough drafts.
Yeah.
So I think that's one source of the self-doubt, is just that writing is a really, really challenging thing to do well.
Yeah. You have this sentence in that section that I loved about self-deprecating statements. You wrote, in saying so, we make it true. And I thought that was really, you know, I mean, the more that we repeat something to ourselves, the more we believe it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, part of the reason I wrote that chapter was to to help people, open the door and write just on a really fundamental level. On another level, though, I think by saying and embracing your identity as a writer and inhabiting that, you will be braver on the page. You will write better. You will take more creative risks. And so I think writers, we do just sometimes err on the side of living in self-doubt instead of just living with, being boldly proclaiming ourselves as writers, and then being more bold about it, which I do think is good. I think it's a really good exercise, a really good, mind attitude check.
Now, Grant, do you do NaNoWriMo each year still?
I do.
You do. So how many novels have you written?
I don't even know. I mean, I've written novels beyond NaNoWriMo, and I have a lot of half-start novels and then novels I've finished or worked on for years. The first year I did NaNoWriMo was 2009, so I guess with the math, this will be my eighth NaNoWriMo.
Okay.
So some of those novels are... I mean, one thing I like about NaNoWriMo is that I can test a novel idea in just 30 days, so it's very efficient. So some of those NaNoWriMo novel ideas I'm still working on.
Yeah.
And then some of them, it just didn't stick. It didn't seem like a great idea, or I wasn't passionate about it, so I had a great experience, and I tested the novel idea, and now I can move on.
Right. Can I talk about another quote from the book that was in another of the sections? You write, "Another name for muse might be routine." I thought that was great.
A lot of writers in general, and we all want to sit down and be so wonderfully inspired, when we write, and of course that's somewhat of a rarity. And I think we create inspiration. I think we misunderstand the difference between those big aha moments of inspiration and the tinier moments of inspiration, which we sometimes don't even recognize.
Right.
And so I'm speaking to those tinier moments of inspiration, which are really the way that any great work gets done or any novel gets finished. And that happens when you sit down every day. And I think you create your inspiration with your words on the page. I mean, I think inspiration actually is kind of whispering between each word, and you're creating a momentum or trying to create a momentum to carry the story forward. And so, I do think routine, the kind of classic notion of a muse as this woman in a gown singing into the ear of a writer with her harpsichord,
Right.
that the muse comes from outside of you. I don't believe in that concept of the muse. I think the muse comes from inside of you and through your work as a writer.
Okay. And yet you wear a different hat each time you write a new project.
Yeah, I do. That idea came from, Nicholson Baker, and he does something different every time he writes a novel. So he might just wear flip-flops instead of his regular shoes. He might write in a different room. He just does something different, and so that's what a hat is to me.
Okay.
It just is kind of like a signal to my brain that I'm entering a different world, and I have this new hat for a new novel.
So it's not necessarily superstitious.
No, it's not necessarily superstitious. It's more just fun.
Okay, because you also have this thing about trinkets, totems, and tchotchkes.
I'm a collector.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I do think, it's funny, writer's desks, writer's desks are fascinating. People do have those, oftentimes at least those collections or those little things that somehow they love to look at or that they give reassurance or that they inspire creativity. So I do think that the way we set up our creative environment can definitely influence or help with our creativity. And I just happen to... Certain objects speak to me. I don't know what it is. They are kind of magical.
Yeah. It's funny. You mentioned the woman in the dress singing, and I actually do have this, thing hanging on my office wall that's, this needle-pointed image of a woman, and I always have thought of her as my muse, so it's sort of funny. I'm not superstitious, but she is there.
Well, I think everybody needs to find the best way to hear their muse,
Yeah.
So I'm not against that concept of the muse singing into your ear. It's just, for me, it represents a misguided notion of creativity in that, we're waiting for creativity to come to us instead of creating it ourselves. So
right.
That
yeah.
muse on your wall is helping you develop the creativity yourself.
Or just setting the scene that helps me find what I'm looking for.
Exactly.
Yeah. So here's another one that you said that I love. I keep pulling all these quotes out, but the book is absolutely full of wonderful little pearls. This one, the idea that a goal plus a deadline equals magic. So there's the real magic, right?
Yeah, well, it is. I think it is fascinating, though, because, as you know, you mentioned that I called myself a slow writer, and before NaNoWriMo, I would oftentimes, you know, that I would work on that first chapter, you know, just forever, you know, for months, and I thought I had to get perfect before I could move on to the next chapter. And so what I was lacking there was the pressure of a goal and a deadline, and so that 50,000 words in 30 days, it puts pressure to move forward, and I do think that there is a magic in that, and without that, I think the you know, it's just kind of looping around and around with a first chapter and not finishing it.
Yeah. So one thing that this made me think about is that a lot of my guests have been journalists before they began writing longer works, and those people tend to be more prolific. I think that they are really used to having a deadline and just kind of moving through a book and getting it out into the world. So this really spoke to that, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, and once you get used to it, it's funny. I mean, I do think writing is kind of like a sport. You train your brain for different types of writing, and I think, like, you know, since I've really embraced this kind of deadline approach, it really has changed the way I approach writing, and so I think there is a magic in that.
Yeah.
Just jumping in again to let you know you're listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. This is an interview with Grant Faulkner. He's an author, and he's also executive director of National Novel Writing Month, which starts on Wednesday. November is the month that lots of people are going to try to write a novel in a month. If you're enjoying the show, please consider liking it on Facebook, rating it in iTunes, or tweeting about Write the Book. Thanks. Stay tuned for the rest of the interview. Thanks.
I also liked, this is another one, I loved the idea, and this, to me, it sort of could be worded as lack of options can actually be a gift. And you were talking about writing in form, and you said, this is a longer quote, do you mind if I quote something here?
No, go for it.
Think of poetry, the box of a poetic form. Whether it's a sonnet, a villanelle, or a haiku, makes the creative act more difficult, yet the requirements of the form force the writer to look beyond obvious associations and consider different words that fit into the rhyming or iambic scheme. Imaginative leaps don't necessarily happen by thinking outside the box, as the popular saying goes, but within the box. And I thought that was so true. I think that's really wonderful advice. How do you apply that to your own work?
Yeah, I think the chapter. Sometimes I think people think the word constraints is a negative thing.
Right.
And I think you can flip it as a creator and make it a positive thing. So one positive is the constraint of writing 50,000 words in a month. Right?
Yes. Right.
So that's like a big kind of creative exercise within a box. But on another level, for me at least, the box of I mentioned poetry in that chapter because it's easy to understand how the different rules of different forms, you know, force you to think differently. In my own writing, 100-word stories did that for me. Mm. That's kind of my other life than NaNoWriMo. And so the idea is that you have to write a story in exactly 100 words. And what I found, I started doing this 6 or 7 years ago just kind of randomly, and it was such a, when I talk about being an athlete or writing is like a sport, writing 100-word stories is like a totally different sport than writing a novel. And I found that I had to, it's mainly an editing exercise.
Okay.
You're constantly tweaking and kind of sculpting the story to try to get it to be within 100 words. You can have a beginning, middle, and end. You can have a character change, so it is a kind of conventional story in a sense.
Right.
But you're writing with hints and suggestions. You have to think about how the gaps in your story, about what's left out, can contribute to the overall story, and then you're also trusting the reader to kind of build the story with you. The reader has to fill in those gaps. And so when I started writing those 100-word stories, I have a collection called Fissures of 100-word stories, and then I run 100-word story magazine with some friends. But writing those really influenced my longer work too, because I think sometimes. So, you know, we have infinite space for a novel. There's no limit. There's no constraint. and sometimes having like no constraint, you can do so much just by over explaining things in novels, for instance. I think we create suspense by what's left out, and so I'm much more attuned when I write a longer work into thinking about what I can leave out to create that suspense and intrigue and invite the reader in more.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Another way I was thinking of constraint was theme. You know, for example, journals will have theme issues, thematic issues, and you have a little bit of lead time, and you have to write about, you know, romance at the circus or whatever it is, which, you know, that might create something that you never would have come up with if you hadn't been trying to write for that particular issue.
That's true. Exactly. Yeah. That's good.
And I remember reading once about a Glimmer Train winner, somebody who had won one of the Glimmer Train contests. He had picked little pieces of paper out of a hat, and each one had something on it. So one had magician, and one had, I don't remember, yellow. And, you know, he picked a bunch of stuff out of a hat and then set himself the task of writing a story that would honor each of these pieces of paper in some way. And he won the Glimmer Train contest with it. So.
That's great. There's so many, like, prompts out there that are similar.
Yeah.
And I love them. And they are, it always tells me how when you do something like that, it defeats writer's block so quickly. One that I like is I just heard about somebody writing a story where each sentence started with the next letter of the alphabet. So the first sentence had to start with an A word, the next sentence with a B word, and so on.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really cool, too.
And very poetic.
And it does force you to think differently. It brings out a different type of creativity, and I think that is one premise of my book, is to explore different types of creativity, because they all work together in the end.
Absolutely. Another one that you mentioned is Ray Bradbury's list-making method. Do you want to talk about that for just a second?
Yeah, that's a favorite one of mine. I think it's very similar to picking the names or the words out of the hat that you mentioned. He, very early in his writing life, he just decided to do this. He would write 20 nouns totally randomly, just from his subconscious, and then he would write these tiny little essays that he called pensées, and by tiny, I mean like 100 or 200 words about each word. And then in that process, he would discover a story and the layers of a story. So, for instance, his novel, Something Wicked This Way Comes, came out of that experience.
Right.
And a lot of his early stories, and I think he used it even throughout his writing life, to discover stories. And it's just one of those things, I think, as writers, you know, sometimes stories come to us just mysteriously while we're taking a shower or driving the car.
Yeah.
And then sometimes we have to be a little bit more deliberate, but I like that process that Ray Bradbury did, because it's both deliberate and it also allows for that mysteriousness to come in.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminded me, I have read part of a book by Robert Olin Butler called, and the method that he uses is called dreamstorming. I can't remember the name of the book, but it's really cool. He basically brainstorms full scenes, and he takes weeks and weeks to do it. And he gets himself into kind of a brainstorming trance every time he sits down to write. And then he will just like literally put it onto an index card, a scene idea and another scene idea and another. And he ends up with hundreds that he then culls through and decides which scenes he's actually going to write and see if they work together. And it's very cool.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So he has this full archive of just random scenes. They're not necessarily like connected, like they're not supposed to be part of a single story.
I think that each time he's working on a project, he lets a character be what leads him into these dreamy scene building things. So I think they are all linked to character, but I can't swear to it.
I like that. That sounds wonderful. I mean, I create mine because one of the parts of NaNoWriMo that I really enjoy, every time before NaNoWriMo happens, there's always a really vibrant conversation among our participants about whether to plan your novel or how much to plan your novel, or whether you should pants your novel and just write it by the seat of your pants. And I'm what I call, or what we call in NaNoWriMo land, a planter. So I'm in between an outliner and a pantser, and I don't like outlines because I feel like it determines the story too much, and while I'm writing it, I'm writing towards my outline instead of writing to the mystery of the story and the kind of quest for the story. But it sounds like he is, and the way I do that is like my planning ends up, I write a lot of little snippets, like little scenes or little character details or whatever it is, and I kind of just collect them for a month or two and then hope they build into a novel, which is somewhat similar to what he's doing.
Yeah.
It sounds like he's much more, he goes deeper than that, though, which sounds really interesting to me.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, let's see. I wonder if you can talk a little bit. I know your book does handle that. I didn't write down which section this is, but your book addresses the idea of jealousy between writers and handling jealousy and being a supportive member of the writing community. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I think envy is a creativity killer.
Yeah.
I think as people and as writers, it's hard to not be envious at times, especially if you're a writer who wants to be published or wants to be published in certain ways. You know, it's a funny thing, because I think you can experience envy for years and not really realize its destructive effects.
Right.
There's a line in that chapter, and let me think if I can remember it. It's like envy is like serving poison to your enemy, but you're the one drinking it.
Yeah.
So you're killing yourself with it. It gains you nothing. And so I one of the great things about writing, I mean, now that I've been writing for years, I actually feel less and less envy. So it's a less destructive force. But in those moments when I do feel it, I just try to flip the channel. I try to do something that is about being generous towards other people, to giving them something. I think about, I'm generally super happy when my friends or people I know are successful writing. So, and then, but sometimes we don't express that. So I try to, you know, send them a note, you know, congratulations on the story you published, whatever it is.
Right.
Or just being generous to the world in general, you know, because envy is a very ungenerous, you know, reaction to the world. I think when you feel envious, you're just naturally less giving to people around you.
Right. Yeah. I think we get so involved in what we're working on, and it is such a solitary process, and it's so hard then to get it out into the world. So I think it makes a lot of sense that envy is natural in this creative pursuit, and I also think it makes a lot of sense that it's destructive. But so
it is. I mean, you know, we all want our, you know, if you're laboring on a novel and you see other people who are, you know, seemingly easily publishing their novels, you know, it's hard not to go negative sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you just mentioned writing little notes to congratulate writers. Do you ever write to your favorite authors, like maybe larger names whose work you appreciate?
I have. I think I did that more when I was younger.
Yeah.
And it was actually pre-internet when I really did that. I wrote Dennis Johnson a letter once. He is a favorite author of mine. He just died earlier this year.
Right. Yeah.
But you know, I was so touched because this was pre-internet. I don't even know how I possibly found out how to reach him, and I wrote him a letter, and he wrote the nicest letter back. I was so, you know, getting a real letter from a big name author like that was so touching, and I always remember that he took the time to do that. You know, he didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
And nowadays it's a little different. I mean, it's interesting how we can have direct contact and with authors, or with our favorite authors on Facebook or Twitter, you know.
Right.
And so I definitely follow some of my favorite authors, and I've, you know, tweeted at them and had little online conversations. So, yeah, it's wonderful to have that kind of access.
Yeah, yeah. I think also, you know, it's always surprising to me. I've had the good fortune of being able to interview some writers that are really big names, and it's really interesting to me to see how humble they mostly are, to see how human they mostly are, you know, to hear that it hurts their feelings when they get a bad review on, you know, like Amazon or Goodreads, and how much it means when they get good feedback.
Absolutely. You know, we all love to be loved, you know.
Exactly.
And it is super touching to get a response from a reader. That's something that never exhausts itself.
Yep.
Like last night I had a book event for Pep Talks, and when you're an author and do book events, you really don't know if anyone's going to show up. No, and when I looked around the room, you know, and I don't know, there were 30 or 40 people there, and I was like, wow, these people gave up 2 hours of their life to come here tonight, you know.
Yeah.
That's just amazing to me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's invigorating.
Now, I wanted to ask, I know you just have this book out, and so you're going to be really busy, plus it's almost November, so you must be, like, tearing your hair out, but do you know what you're going to write next? Do you have any ideas about what it's going to start out as?
You know, this particular NaNoWriMo has been the most challenging for me, because I have been busier than ever, you know, both with the book, with my job, and with other things.
Yeah.
And I haven't had the mind space to really think about what I'm going to write in November, and so, you know, just literally a few days ago, I looked up at the calendar. I'm losing track of days. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is happening really soon. And I always, you know, my advice, because a lot of people have a hard time deciding what to write, and I always tell them, write, you know, you need to write what you're most passionate about, what's really calling you in your heart. And sometimes it's tough. We have two novel ideas that might be the equivalent, but I want NaNoWriMo to always be like a good experience and to have your story idea calling you every day. And so the ideas I had, just because I'm a little depleted with energy, I didn't think I could give them my full, you know, I don't know, passion in November. So I'm choosing to do something very, very different this year.
Oh.
I just decided this yesterday, so who knows if it'll happen, but I am interested in writing personal essays, but I'm going to do it in a form that I guess I could technically call it a memoir. The form comes from Czesław Miłosz, and I think this was a form that comes from Polish culture. He calls it the ABCs, and he wrote a whole book of ABCs. And what you do is you just take the alphabet, and it's kind of like almost like the Ray Bradbury noun. Challenge is that you just like in the A category it might be apple, aardvark, in the, you know, C category it might be candy, in the Z category it might be zoo, and anyway you're just choosing words and then you're writing about those words, and so it might be a small life experience related to apples or candy, for instance. And so you just, I mean, it goes back to my 100-word story,
right?
Aesthetic. And I view my life, when I think about it as a memoir, at least, I enjoy thinking about that kind of collage of snapshots that really makes up my memory. And so I thought it would be interesting to do a memoir because I've never written in that way before. And I am thinking about this, like, not necessarily as something that I want to publish as a memoir, but something that I could, by exploring my memories and trying to reimagine them and re-see them, I thought it could contribute to other works, you know.
Yeah.
So I think it is, in some ways, it's like the Robert Olin Butler experiment but instead of writing a lot of scenes attached to a character, the scenes will be kind of attached to my character, but maybe I can use them in fiction as well.
That's great. I love that. That sounds really interesting. And also probably a way in, you know, particularly if you've been super busy and it's hard to get ready.
That's exactly it. I just thought it would be a way in, you know, and a way for me to, like, every day it would be easy for me to find some letter, some word in the alphabet to start writing about.
Okay. Now, do you have time to read? Do you read?
Thank you for asking that. It is one of the disturbing parts of my life that I'm reading less than I used to.
Yeah.
And I don't like that, but I don't know a way around it because I wake up every morning at 4, and I, you know, by the time I'm done with the day, it's 8 or 9, and I'm pretty much ready to go to bed.
Yeah.
So I read less, unfortunately, but I do very deliberately try to carve out time to read, you know, and it is my main source of creative replenishment.
Yeah.
So especially on the weekends, I usually begin Saturday and Sunday morning with just 2 or 3 hours of reading, just to replenish, really. But also, you know, I mean, I there's so many books, you know, I'm never going to be able to read them all. So, you know, so I hope my life is more accommodating to reading soon.
Yeah. Now, I always ask people if they've read anything they would recommend to listeners.
You know, I think, like, as a reader, There's always the question of how deep you go into an author, right?
Because right.
There are so many books in the world, and I you know, every time the New York Times Book Review, you know, arrives, there's two or three more books I want to read, but of course I can't read them all.
Right.
So it's like, do you be a generalist and try to read more books from more authors, or do you go deep into one author? And at this stage in my life, I think I want to go deeper into the people who have really influenced me or who I love. And so, for instance, I just finished Leonard Cohen's biography, and he was a fiction writer. He did write novels, and I do want to read his novels, but I've been going back and listening to his music and referring to the biography to think more deeply about his music, and then I'm reading his poetry.
Yeah.
I always try to keep a book of poetry because I think reading poetry is really good for prose writers. I think it helps you think about language in different ways. So right now I'm doing the Leonard Cohen project, essentially.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you like the book?
The biography is fantastic.
Yeah, okay.
It was written before he died, but it is one of my favorite biographies.
Yeah.
So I recommend it, yeah.
Okay, great.
I think it's called I'm Your Man.
Let's see. You have a section in Pep Talks where you talk about there's an upside to the critical inner editor. And I thought that was really interesting. And also, you don't hear people say that very often. So do you want to just talk for a minute about that?
Yeah, I think one of the lessons as an author that you need to learn by practicing really is when to banish your inner editor and when to invite your inner editor back in.
Mm-hmm.
And then also to think about who your inner editor is and how your inner editor is speaking to you. And with the NaNoWriMo kind of a creative experiment, we banish the inner editor and just write the novel, you know. And that's to help do everything I've already talked about. Open yourself up, write with abandon, finish your novel, get rid of the obstacles. But at a certain point, you know, your inner editor, like, never truly goes away. Your inner editor always wants to rise up and kind of tell you what to do. Because your inner editor wants that novel to be really good.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of a challenge. The inner editor is a challenging taskmaster. And so, but I think you have to figure out, is your inner editor, like, there's this concept of perfectionism that the definition is, and this comes from Brené Brown, and who's a popular,
yeah,
has the most popular TED Talks ever. But I think she says that perfectionism, most of us, perfectionism means that we're trying to meet other people's standards. And that's why it's so painful, is that we're always trying to impress others with by making something perfect, or that we live within that kind of insecurity. And so I think you have to, like, turn off of that type of inner editor and really try to nourish an inner editor that's more about, like, helping you reach your potential on the page. It's kind of a fine line, but I think you have to, you can hear those voices, and they are different. And so I try to, like, invite that inner editor in who is really going to help me improve the story and make it as good as possible.
Yeah.
So I'm not getting into that terrain where I'm comparing my stories to other authors and then saying, oh, I'm not doing well enough. And I'm nourishing self-doubt in that sense, I think.
Do you find that you invite the inner editor more frequently when you're revising than you might in your first draft?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing. That is the I mean, again, you're training your writing muscles by doing NaNoWriMo. And you were, one of those muscles you're training during NaNoWriMo is how to banish that inner editor in the rough draft. And I think almost every writer I've ever talked to, no matter what their process, they say the same. They say that you've got to just open up the floodgates of your imagination in that rough draft.
Yeah. Okay. Here's a question for you. Which do you suffer from more, fear of failure or fear of success? Which I do think is a thing.
Yeah. Gosh. I think fear of failure.
Yeah.
I haven't had any. I'll take it success wherever I can find it, I guess. I do sometimes, you know, now that I'm somewhat older, I am glad that I didn't have the success I might have wanted when I was younger. I just think with my perspective now, it wouldn't have been good for me creatively. I wouldn't have known how to handle it.
Right.
And I think all those years of not having great publishing success nourished a humility and maybe even made me more demanding on myself, helped me experiment creatively. I think success can be bad for you. Hopefully it finds you when you're really ready for it and when it can help you.
Yeah. I think that sometimes... when I say fear of success, I'm thinking of the things that make us procrastinate pursuing publication after we're finished. And this is actually, maybe I'm just talking to myself, but this is something that I do. I'll finish a novel. I'll actually finish, you know, like my 10th revision and feel like I'm finally there. And then I find all kinds of reasons not to send it out. And it's like, what is that about?
You know, I have that. I'm similar. I don't think I'm fearing success. What I think I'm just bad at that side of things.
And that could be, yeah.
Like I really want to just keep writing and writing on other projects. And then when I'm doing that, I'll suddenly realize, wow, I just spent all this time on this short story, and I've only sent it out to one literary journal, you know?
Right.
Whereas what I really need to do is say, okay, I'm not writing next Saturday. I'm going to spend 6 hours submitting. And so I just don't give myself enough time to do that, what I call the business side of writing.
Yes.
Which is unfortunate, because I think, like, as you mature as a writer and as you have more and more things to submit and try to publish, you do need to carve out that time in a very structured way and make sure that you are putting your work out there. Because I can't remember all the numbers, but somebody recently said, I think the person's goal was to get 100 rejections or to submit 100 times within a calendar year. And I thought that was pretty good advice. However you want to determine your own number, but
right.
I think the goal should be very high. And you should track it, just like in NaNoWriMo. That's the other thing. I track it on a spreadsheet, but I don't count the number of submissions in a year. So maybe I'll make this New Year's resolution for myself next year. And the idea, though, is that by submitting more, it's almost like a sports team. You're taking more shots, and the team that takes more shots usually wins.
And are you talking about submitting stories or novel submissions?
Well, I think either.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
Depending on where you are. For me, like, I mean, the story submissions are more like the 100.
Yeah.
But you know what? I think J.K. Rowling, was she turned down by 30 agents or something like that?
Yeah.
So many authors have those stories about just a huge number of rejections before they become successful.
Right.
So I think and I have talked to writers who they'll submit their novel to one or two agents and they'll be rejected, and then they'll say, oh, that's it, it's not good enough.
Right.
And I always tell them to go more, because it's just such a crazy world out there for publishers and agents, and they get so many submissions, and who knows what attention they even gave your query letter.
Right.
So I would shoot, give 50 rejections for your novel.
Yeah. Okay. And I have a question about that in a minute. I've got two questions left for you, Grant. The first one I wanted to ask you about is, I loved this part of Pep Talks for Writers. Life's irritants are like a training ground for a creative mind. How can you flip the scene to make it a symphony? And I loved that. And so you're talking about like sitting in traffic or standing in line at the grocery store, all these sort of irritating little moments where you'd rather be doing something else can actually become moments for creativity. I loved that.
Yeah. I think, I don't know. I've certainly let life and life's annoyances get the better of me.
Yeah.
And especially like the when you're sitting there in a traffic jam. I mean, if you don't live in a city, you might not experience this so much, but it could be a traffic jam or it could be waiting in a long line at the grocery store.
Right.
And, as we get impatient, we honor our impatience and we let it take over our mind. And it's really a creativity killer, just like envy. And I think so. I think any of those moments in life where you are feeling something that is a creativity killer, I think there are ways to flip it, right?
Right.
Like you can take a few deep breaths. You can, while you're in a traffic jam, you can treat it as a meditative experience.
Right.
And you can invite in daydreams. You know, it's a wonderful opportunity to think through your story or to think through your memories. So I think it's just a matter of like when you feel life's irritants kind of clawing up into your brain, just thinking like, okay, what can I do to get rid of them and to soften my thoughts?
Yeah, yeah. I thought that was really useful. And it's funny, it seems to kind of relate to me a little bit to, you know how when you're driving in the car and all of a sudden you get an idea to either write something down or, I don't know, do something that you need to do, and then you'll never hit a red light, never. It's like once you give yourself a task that irritating moment could be useful for, it won't happen. So
it's true.
Okay, I have this last question for you, and a lot of my listeners are writers, and I'm just wondering if you could offer some advice for handling rejection, which is something else you talk about in Pep Talks for Writers.
Mm-hmm. I think it was a Sylvia Plath quote that I quote in that chapter where she said rejections are proof, like they're a good thing, because they're proof that she was writing and putting her work out there.
Right.
And I thought that was a really healthy way to think about it. Rejections most of the times, I mean, they come, at least in the publishing process, most of them come from people we don't even know.
Yeah.
That we have met, we don't know who they are, and we don't know what the criteria of their rejection necessarily is. And so I think authors can err on the side of taking that way too personally. And so I think you just need to treat rejections as, who knows where this came from, and I'm not going to take it too personally and move on. The other thing, though, I think it is about your mindset and preparing yourself for rejection. Not assuming you're going to get it. You don't want to defeat your energy of putting your work out there.
Right.
But just knowing it's part of the game. You are going to be rejected. Being a writer is more about failure than success in
yeah.
most cases.
Yeah.
In all cases, really. I think it was Philip Roth who compared writing to playing baseball, in the sense that a really, really good hitter in baseball hits the know, so you're missing more than you're hitting, but you
right.
still go back to the plate and try again. And so I think it is that healthy striving. You just keep going forward. You trust in the endeavor itself rather than necessarily the arrival in the glory land of acceptance.
Right.
Also, I think writers need to remember that when you're accepted and when you're published, it's not like this. You don't arrive in heaven.
Right.
You know, it's a wonderful moment. And, of course, you know, that's what many of us are gearing our writing towards. But it quickly evaporates. I like this quote from Robin Williams where he said, you know, you get the Oscar and you go to the parties and everyone's, like, celebrating you. And you have this glow from that for maybe 2 or 3 days. And then life is entirely back to normal, you know, after that. You know, and I think the same thing happens with publishing, is that you feel that warmth and that love, and it's wonderful. But you know, usually the next morning you wake up and you're back to your normal life and you're back to your normal writing challenges.
Yeah. That's a great quote to add to that. I think that's so true. You know, you're back to buying milk at the grocery store. And
yeah, you got to deal with yourself. You know,
yeah.
you never leave yourself, you know, at least not for too long.
Right, so. Right. The name of the book, once again, is Pep Talks for Writers, 52 Insights and Actions to Boost Your Creative Mojo by Grant Faulkner, who is the Executive Director of National Novel Writing Month. NaNoWriMo happens in November, so starting very soon. The book is published by Chronicle Books. Grant, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you. This was a great interview. Great talk.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was a conversation with Grant Faulkner. You can learn more about his work at grantfaulkner.com, and you can read more about NaNoWriMo at nanowrimo.org. And while I'm on the subject, I will just wish good luck to all the people who are going to be participating in NaNoWriMo. The people I know personally would be Lissa and Joyce and Tammy Greenwood and the Lalonde family. So, but good luck to all of you. The book that Grant mentioned about Leonard Cohen is I'm Your Man, The Life of Leonard Cohen by Sylvie Simmons. And if you're thinking of going deep, as Grant said, exploring Cohen's poems and songs as well, I just looked online and ran across one that's part of the Everyman's Library Pocket Poets series called Poems and Songs, published in 2011. By Leonard Cohen, with an introduction by Robert Fagan, who's listed as the editor. Okay, so next week on Write the Book, I'll share an interview with Vermont author Adam Fetterman, whose new book is Fasting and Feasting, The Life of Visionary Food Writer Patience Gray, published by Chelsea Green. So as promised, I'm offering multiple Write the Book prompts this week, and the next two are from Grant Faulkner's new book, Pep Talks for Writers, 52 Insights and Actions to Boost Your Creative Mojo. These might be of particular value if you're participating in NaNoWriMo this November. So first, set a goal, set a deadline. This is a quote from the book. This is the big moment. Map out your writing goals, big goals, and all the milestones that lead up to them. Pin a piece of paper with your goals over your writing desk. Tattoo them on your arm if need be. Set deadlines on your online calendar with reminders. Form a strategy of accountability and enact it. Okay, and that is from Grant's sixth pep talk, Goal Plus Deadline Equals Magic. His seventh is titled Embrace Constraints, and it's in this pep talk that he explains writing sprints, which we talked about during the interview. So here is one more for you. This is a quote from the book, Explore the Creative Power of Limitations. Set a timer for 15 or 30 minutes and push yourself to simply dive into your novel wherever you can. This strategy is similar to the Pomodoro technique, a time management method that breaks down work into intervals separated by short breaks. Bursts of focus with frequent breaks can improve your mental agility. I'll just mention that I've had great success with that one. So good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. And once again, if you're planning to participate in NaNoWriMo, good luck and go for it. And don't forget that the organization offers lots of support at NaNoWriMo.org. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Do know that the show is pretty well booked for the rest of the year, but I still like to hear from people. If you have guests that you want me to pursue for 2018, I'd love to hear from you. If you like the show, again, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, tell all of your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you have been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.